And 5 years on, as Michael Gove just said in that brilliant speech, they still want to spend more, borrow more, and tax more. It is the same old Labour. And you know what? They say that madness is doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting different results. Well, I say madness is voting for this high-spending, high-taxing, deficit-ballooning shower of an opposition and expecting anything other than an economic disaster. Now, in a country that everyone is proud to call home, you should be able to buy a home if you're willing to save. It shouldn't be some impossible dream. But we inherited a situation where it was. Young people watched location, 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 not as a reality show, but as a fantasy. We couldn't solve this housing crisis without some difficult decisions. The planning system was stuck in the mud, so we reformed it. And last year, nearly 250,000 houses were given planning permission. Young people needed massive deposits they just couldn't afford. So we brought in Help to Buy. Now, of course, there were those who criticised it, usually speaking from the comfort of the home that they'd bought some years ago. But let's see what actually happened. They said Help to Buy would just help people in London. But 94% of buyers live outside the capital. They said it would help people with houses already, but four-fifths are first-time buyers. They said it would cause a housing bubble, but as the Bank of England has said, it hasn't. So here is our renewed commitment to first-time buyers. If you're prepared to work and save, we will help you get a place of your own. At this conference, we've announced a landmark new policy. It's called Starter Homes. We're going to build 100,000 new homes, and they will be at least 20% cheaper than normal. But here's the crucial part. Buy-to-let landlords won't be able to snap them up. Wealthy foreigners won't be able to buy them. Just first-time buyers under the age of 40. Homes built for you, made for you. Our party, the Conservative Party, the party of home ownership, once again. In a Britain that everyone is proud to call home, you wouldn't be able to tell a child's GCSEs by their postcode or by what their parents do. There must be a great education for every child. A month ago, I had this wonderful moment. Florence is now 4 and just starting school, so for the first time, all 3 of my children are at the same primary school. And it was such a joy to take them all there together. Florence sort of clinging on for dear life until suddenly she saw a new friend and rushed into her classroom, not a backward glance, something dads have to get used to. And it is hard to describe what a relief it is as a parent to find a decent school for your child. But it shouldn't be a lottery. What we have, what Sam and I have in our state primary in London, I want for every child in our country. And we are getting there. More children in good or outstanding schools. More children studying sciences, language and history. A new curriculum with 5-year-olds learning fractions. 11-year-olds coding computers. Like me, you're probably finding the homework harder and harder every night it comes back. But you know what? The biggest change that first Michael and now Nikki and their team are bringing about, the biggest change is the culture. We've got teachers who feel like leaders again, who say, this is our school, we're proud of it, the children must behave in it, and we will not tolerate failure within it. We have come so far. And make no mistake, the biggest risk to all this is Labour. You know what drives me most mad about them? It is the hypocrisy. Tristram Hunt, the shadow education secretary, like me, had one of the best educations that money can buy. But guess what? He won't allow it for your children. He went to an independent school that wasn't set up by a local authority, But no, he doesn't want charities and parents to set up schools for your children. He had the benefit of world-class teachers who happen not to have some government certificate. But no, he wants to stop people like that from teaching your children. I tell you, Tristram Hunt and I might both have had an education at some of the best schools in our country. But here is the difference. You, Tristram, like the rest of Labour, want to restrict those advantages. I want to spread them to every child in our country. Now, we know Labour's real problem on education. Every move they make, they have to take their cue from the unions. That is who they really represent, the unions. Well, I've got a bit of news for you. It's something we've never really said before. We in this party, we are a trade union too. And I tell you who we represent. This party is the union for hard-working parents, for the father who reads his children's stories at night because he wants them to learn, the mother who works all the hours God sends to give her children the best start. This party is the trade union for children from the poorest estates and the most chaotic homes. This party is the union for the young woman who wants an apprenticeship, for the teenagers who want to make something of their lives. This is who we resent. These are the people that we are fighting for, and that is why on education we will not let Labour drag us back to square one. We're going to finish what we have begun. A real education is not just about exams. Our young people must know that this is a country where if you put in, you will get out. Now, I've got in some trouble before for talking about Twitter. In fact, I've got in trouble for talking about quite a lot of things recently, but we'll pass over that. But I want a country where young people aren't endlessly thinking, what can I say in 140 characters, but what does my character say about me? And that is why I'm so proud of National Citizen Service. Every summer, thousands of young people are coming together to volunteer and serve their community. We started this. People come up to me on the streets and say all sorts of things, and believe me, they really do say all sorts of things. But one thing I hear a lot is parents saying about National Citizen Service, thank you for what this has done for my child. And I want this to become a rite of passage for all teenagers in our country. So I can tell you this. The next Conservative government will guarantee a place on National Citizen Service for every teenager in our country. Now that rule, that if you put in, you should get out. More than anywhere, it should apply to those who want dignity and security in retirement. But for years, it didn't. There were, I think, three great wrongs. Wrong number one, the pension credit that was basically a means test. The more you saved, the less you got. Wrong number two, compulsory annuities that meant you couldn't spend your own money as you wished. Wrong number three, when people passed away, the pension they had saved was taxed at 55% before it went to their family. Three wrongs, and we are putting each one right. The means test, it is going. In its place, a new single-tier pension of £142 a week. Every penny you save during your working life, you will keep. Those compulsory annuities, scrapped, giving you complete control over your private pension. And as for that 55% tax on your pension, you heard it this week. We've cut it to 0%. Conservative values in action. But when it comes to our elderly, there's perhaps one thing that matters above everything. And that is knowing the NHS is there for you. Now, from Labour last week, we heard the same old rubbish about the Conservatives and the NHS. They were spreading complete and utter lies. And I just think, how dare you? It was the Labour Party who gave us the scandal at Midstaffs, elderly people begging for water and dying of neglect. And for me, this is personal. I'm someone who has relied on the NHS and whose family knows more than most just how important it is, who knows what it's like when you go to hospital night after night with a sick child in your arms, knowing that when you get there, there were people who will love that child and care for that child just as like it was their own. And how dare they suggest I would ever put that at risk for other people's children? How dare they frighten those who rely on a National Health Service? We in this party, I believe we can be proud of what we've done. We came in and we protected the NHS budget. We funded 6,500 more doctors, 3,300 more nurses, a cancer drugs fund to save lives, and more people hearing those two magic words, all clear. And think of the amazing things around the corner. From the country that unravelled DNA, we are now mapping it for each individual. It's called the genome, and I've got a model of one of the first ones on my desk in Downing Street. Cracking this code could mean curing rare genetic diseases and saving lives. Our NHS is leading the world on this incredible technology, and I understand very personally the differences it could make. When you've had a child who's so ill and the doctors can't work out what he's got or why, you would give anything to know. And the investment we're making will mean that more parents will have those answers and hopefully the cures that go with them. But let us also be clear. All this is only possible because we've managed our economy responsibly. And that is why I can tell you this today. We will do it again. The next Conservative government will protect the NHS budget and continue to invest more. Because we know this truth, something Labour will never understand and we will never forget. You can only have a strong NHS if you have a strong economy. A Britain that everyone is proud to call home. A place where reward follows effort, where if you put in, you get out. But it also means a country that is strong in the world and in control of its own destiny. And yes, that includes controlling immigration. To me, this is all about working on all fronts. It's about getting our own people fit for work, fixing welfare so a life on the dole is not an option, fixing education so we turn out young people with skills to do the jobs that we're creating. And yes, we need controlled borders and an immigration system that puts the British people first. That is why we've capped economic migration from outside the EU. We've shut down 700 bogus colleges that were basically visa factories. We've kicked out people who don't belong here, like Abu Qatada. And let's hear it for the woman who made it happen, our crime-busting Home Secretary Theresa May. But we know the bigger issue today is migration from within the EU. Immediate access to our welfare system, paying benefits to families back at home, employment agencies signing up people from overseas, not recruiting here, numbers that have increased faster than we in this country wanted, and at a level that was too much for our communities and for our labour markets. All of this has to change, and it will be at the very heart of my renegotiation strategy for Europe. Britain, I know you want this sorted. So I will go to Brussels. I will not take no for an answer. And when it comes to free movement, I will get what Britain needs. And anyone who thinks I can't or won't deliver this, I would say judge me by my record. I'm the first Prime Minister to veto a treaty, the first Prime Minister to cut the European budget. And yes, I pulled us out of those European bailout schemes as well. Around that table in Europe, they know I say what I mean, and I mean what I say. So we're going to go in as a country, we're going to get our powers back, we're going to fight for our national interest, and yes, we'll put it to a referendum, in or out, it will be your choice, and let the message go out from this hall, it is only with the Conservatives that you will get that choice. Now, of course, it's not just the European Union that needs sorting out. It is the European Court of Human Rights, too. When that charter was written, in the aftermath of the Second World War, it set out the basic rights that we should respect. But since then, interpretations of that charter have led to a whole lot of things are frankly wrong. Rulings to stop us deporting suspected terrorists. The suggestion that you've got to apply the Human Rights Convention even on the battlefields of Helmand. And now they want to give prisoners the vote. No, I'm sorry, I just don't agree. Our Parliament, the British Parliament, decided they shouldn't have that right. This is the country that wrote Magna Carta, the country that time and again has stood up for human rights, whether liberating Europe from fascism or leading the charge against sexual violence in war. Let me put it very clearly. We do not require instruction from judges in Strasbourg on this issue. So at long last, with a Conservative government after the next election, this country will have a new British Bill of Rights to be passed in our Parliament, rooted in our values. And as for Labour's Human Rights Act, we will scrap it once and for all. So that is what we offer. A Britain everyone is proud to call home, and a very clear plan to get there. Over the next 5 years, we will deliver the following things. 3 million apprenticeships. Full employment. The most competitive corporate taxes in the G20. Eliminating the budget deficit through spending cuts, not tax rises. Building 100,000 new starter homes. Letting you pass on your pension tax-free. Ring-fencing NHS spending so not a penny is cut. Renegotiating in Europe. Delivering that in-out referendum. Scrapping the Human Rights Act. No income tax until you earn £12,500. And no 40p tax rate until you earn £50,000. If you want those things, vote for me. If you don't, vote for the other guy. And let's be clear. Let us be clear. This is a straight fight. It doesn't matter whether Parliament is hung, drawn, or quartered. There is only one real choice. The Conservatives or Labour. Me in Downing Street or Ed Miliband in Downing Street. If you vote UKIP, that is really a vote for Labour. And here's a thought. Here is a thought for you. On the 7th of May, you could go to bed with Nigel Farage and wake up with Ed Miliband. I don't know about you, but not one bit of that works for me. So here is the big question for that election. On the things that matter in your life, Who do you really trust? When it comes to your job, do you trust Labour, who wrecked our economy, or the Conservatives, who've made this one of the fastest-growing economies in the West? When it comes to Britain's future, who do you trust? Labour, the party of something for nothing and human wrongs under the banner of human rights, or the Conservatives, who believe in something for something and reward for hard work? Who do you trust? The party of big debt, big spending, big borrowing, or the party, our party, of the first paycheck, the first chance, the first home, the one that is delivering more security, more opportunity, more hope, the one that is making this country great again? Yes, our party, the Conservative Party, that is the choice at the next election. We are making Britain proud again. Look what we're showing the world. Not just a country that's paying down its debts and going from the deepest recession since the war to the fastest growing major advanced economy in the world, but at the same time, a country that's kept its promises to the poorest in the world, that is leading, not following, on climate change, and that has just saved our United Kingdom in one of the greatest shows of democracy the world's ever seen. We're making Britain proud again. Our exports to China doubling. Our car industry booming. Our aerospace expanding. Our manufacturing growing. We're making Britain proud again. Car engines not imported from Germany, but built down the road in Wolverhampton. New oil rigs not made in China, but built on the Tyne. Record levels of employment. Record numbers of apprenticeships. Britain regaining its purpose, its pride, and its confidence. We are at the moment where all the hard work is finally paying off, and the light is coming up after some long, dark days. Go back now and we'll lose all we've done, falling back into the shadows when we should be striding into the sun. That's the question next May. Do you want to go back to square one or finish what we have begun? I don't claim to be a perfect leader, but I'm your public servant, standing here wanting to make our country so much better for your children and mine. I love this country, and I will do my duty by it. We've got the track record, the right team, to take this plan for our country and turn it into a plan for you. I think of the millions of people going out to work, wiping the ice off the windscreen on a winter's morning, raising their children as well as they can, working as hard as they can, doing it for a better future, to make a good life for them and their families. That is the British spirit. It's there in our ordinary days as well as in our finest hours. This is a great country, and we can be greater still, because history's not written for us, but by us in the decisions that we make today. And that starts next May. So Britain, what's it going to be? I say let's not go back to square one. Let us finish what we have begun. Let us build a Britain we are proud to call home, for you, for your family, for everyone.
Thank you. The British House of Commons will be in recess over the next few weeks so party leaders can attend their annual conferences. The House of Commons returns in mid-October. You can watch past Prime Minister's questions or other British programming on our website at cspan.org. Next, International Monetary Fund Director Christine Lagarde talks about the IMF's growth outlook. At 11 p.m., Q&A with Janetta Cole, Director of the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art. Then another chance to see British Prime Minister David Cameron speak at the Conservative Party's annual conference. On Thursday, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde said that the global economy is weaker than anticipated, and the IMF's economic growth outlook has been pared down. She also previewed this week's IMF World Bank annual meetings in Washington, D.C. This is just over an hour.
Well, good morning. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you to Gaston Hall. I want to thank you for joining us this morning. For more than a century, this hall has served as one of the most important places for public discourse and discussion here in Washington. And today we deepen that history as we come together to engage in conversation on the most pressing issues facing our global economy. And to provide her insights, we are honored to have with us Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde. The 11th person to serve in this role and the first woman, Madame Lagarde has stewarded the IMF during a period of great challenge in our global financial environment. And she's here today to talk about a way forward and the role the IMF is playing to promote financial stability and growth around the world. There is great urgency to this work, and from how we respond to issues of poverty and inequality to our assumptions about growth in our economies. As a university, it is our role to imagine anew how we can better care for one another, how we can build our societies so that they can be more inclusive, how together we can address the challenges that confront us, whether through the formation of our students as women and men for others, through the inquiry of our faculty, and in the responsibility that we have in promoting the common good. It is the ethos, the characteristic spirit of the university to seek the betterment of humankind. You can see this work come alive in settings like this, and in the context of the global economy and the work of programs like our Masters in Global Human Development, our Masters in Applied Economics, and our McCourt School of Public Policy, where we recently announced that George Akerlof, 2001 Nobel Prize winner in Economic Sciences, currently senior resident scholar at the IMF, will be joining our faculty in November. In today's lecture, we seek to gain a deeper understanding of the financial challenges and opportunities of this moment, and to engage in conversation on the policies and approaches that contribute to global prosperity and economic opportunity for all people. An experienced government minister, an expert in antitrust and labor issues, the first woman to serve as finance minister of a G7 nation, and the first woman chairperson of the American law firm Baker & McKenzie, Madame Lagarde offers an unparalleled perspective into the global financial system. She has held various posts in the French government, including Minister of Economic Affairs, Finance and Employment, and Minister of Agriculture and Fisheries. And in 2009, the Financial Times named her the best Minister of Finance in the Eurozone. She also served as chair of the G20 when France assumed its presidency for the year 2011, and in that role launched a wide-ranging agenda on the reform of the international monetary system. In her role as Managing Director of the IMF, a post she has held since 2011, she has sought to bring stability to the global economy, advance economic opportunities for women, strengthen member state representation, and promote inclusive and effective economic growth policies. In a recent address in Mexico at the International Forum for Financial Inclusion, she described the economic imperative of developing an inclusive economic system. She said, "Inequality is not just a moral issue. It is a macroeconomic issue." She continued, "Our research tells us that countries with higher inequality tend to have lower and less durable growth. Inequality chokes the prospects for individuals to realize their full potential and contribute to society. Whether it is through personal experience or empirical evidence, one thing is clear. Growth has to be more inclusive, and for this, finance has to be more inclusive." We welcome Madame Lagarde to campus today at a moment of significance for the IMF as they approach their annual meetings here in Washington. We're grateful for her presence and for the insights that she will share with our community. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor for me to welcome to the podium Christine Lagarde.
Good morning to all of you. And President DeGioia, I would like to thank you very much for your introduction. And I would like to especially thank you for having quoted that speech that I gave in Mexico. It's definitely a country that epitomizes some of the points that I will try to make in the course of my remarks this morning. And it's a country that tries to include particularly those that do not have access to finance, those that do not have access to the job market, and I mean by that often the poorest and very frequently the women. Madam Ambassador, delighted to see you here. Mr. Dean, I'm very pleased to look forward to you handling the questions from the many of you who are here today, and it's very, very nice to be here at Georgetown University. I'm really honored to be hosted by one of the finest schools of foreign service. I looked at your mission statement, and correct me if I get that wrong, but I read that your mission is to contribute to global peace, prosperity, and human well-being by educating future generations of world leaders. Now, the founders of your school back in a year that is very famous for me, 1789. The founders of your school had a very ambitious and sustainable vision. I don't know whether they were inspired by some of the writers who certainly inspired what happened in France around the Bastille in 1789, but I'm sure that they had no idea that only 70 years ago, in 1944, the Bretton Woods institutions, including the IMF, would be founded with pretty much the same purpose and the same mission, although using, of course, different means. The focus of your institution is education. Our focus is stability around the world, using all the means that were then available and which, I will tell you later on, have evolved over time. So we are in the same boat. And as I look at the grey and blue colours of Georgetown University, the colours that adorn your beautiful campus and the colours that I have tried to replicate with my scarf, I'm actually reminded of the themes that I would like to touch upon today. Because essentially what I will focus on is the clouds, the grey clouds that we have on the horizon and the blue skies that most populations around the world aspire to. And we have that antagony at the moment between the aspiration for this blue sky and the grey clouds that are piling up. But before I do that, because those will be the topics addressed, as you said, Mr. President, next week by the 188 finance ministers and the 188 governors of central banks from around the world, that's the membership of the IMF, they will be focusing on that. They will also discuss how the IMF can contribute to pushing out some of these grey clouds. So let me just tell you a little bit about the IMF on the occasion of that 70th anniversary that we are celebrating. It was founded, as I said, 1944, as the World War II was getting to a close, hopefully, in New Hampshire, Bretton Woods. And for the last 70 years, we've been doing quite a few things. We've been fighting many crises around the world, starting in Europe, moving over to Asia, focusing on Latin America, then the former Soviet Union countries. We have helped many developing countries integrating into the global economy. We have provided enormous support, technical assistance, capacity buildings around. And historically, we were very much a referee of variation of currencies. That role has indeed faded away as the monetary system has evolved from what was predominantly a fixed exchange rate to what is predominantly a floating exchange rate. So the circumstances have changed, but certainly the firefighting activity, the surveillance activity, the monitoring, and the support and help that we can provide, that is still with us. In the recent years, we have provided financial support through programs to many countries around the world, predominantly in Europe. We were back in Europe in many ways. And in recent months, we have extended support to countries like Ukraine, countries in the Middle East, and most recently, the three African countries that are the victim of Ebola. We put together in just next to no time, literally, a financial package of about $130 million in order to give them additional budgetary support so that they can face the shortfall of revenue and the additional spending that they have to engage. Our main job now is, as I said earlier on, to try to push the clouds out, because you will see numbers and you hear about numbers. There is some economic recovery. But as we all know, and as we can feel it, because we have family members, friends, relatives, people that we know who are looking for a job, who do not have the means that they would like to have, that growth is not enough to respond to the challenges that the world is facing. So what should be done? Well, we believe that the clouds can be pushed, provided that all policymakers actually aim higher, try harder, do it together, and are country-specific. And I will touch on all of that. So what do I mean by that? Aim higher, try harder, do it together. I mean, there has to be a new momentum. A new momentum that will consist of putting a set of bolder policies together in order to overcome what I would call the new mediocre. And that's a risk if it stagnates as such, if we have this horizon of new mediocre. So what I will focus on is, first of all, the state of the global economy as we see it at the moment, and the risk that the world gets stuck in that new mediocre. And second, I would like to describe for you how all policymakers can generate the policy momentum that is needed to power up the global activity and overcome that new mediocre horizon. And of course, I will conclude with, that really comes back to us in a way, what I regard as essential going forward, and that is this new multilateralism, which requires increased cooperation amongst policymakers, amongst countries. So let's have a quick look at the state of the global economy as it is at the moment. I'm not going to give you very specific numbers, because they will be released next week when we bring all the finance ministers and governors of central banks together. But suffice to say at this point, the global economy is weaker than we had hoped only 6 months ago. So there is recovery, don't get me wrong, but it's weaker than what we had thought. And we forecast a modest pickup in 2015 as, and that's an important factor, the outlook for potential growth has been pared down. Now, as I said earlier, it's country specific and the prospects are different depending on where you sit or where you look at. Among the advanced economies, clearly the United States of America and in Europe the United Kingdom are leading the charge and expected to be stronger. The recovery is much more modest in Japan, and it's the weakest in the euro area, where there are disparities within the same currency zone. Turning to the emerging and developing economies, they have been doing all the heavy lifting in the last 5 years. They've contributed roughly 80% of global growth in the last 5 years, and led by Asia predominantly, given the size and the growth, particularly China, they will continue to contribute massively. But them too are likely to do that at a slightly slower pace, because we're all interconnected. If some of the players are a bit slower, they're going to be affected too. Now, for the low-income and developing countries, including sub-Saharan Africa, the economic prospects are rising. I'll come to the risk in a minute. But the economic prospects are rising in the main. However, because some of them have been borrowing quite extensively and issuing on the markets, their debt level has increased. So they should be watching. Finally, in the Middle East, the outlook is clouded by difficult economic transitions and, of course, by intense tension and political strife. So the bottom line of all that, 6 years after the financial crisis, we continue to see weakness in the global economy. Countries are still dealing with the legacies of the crisis. And what do I mean by that? A much higher debt level, both at sovereign and quite often at corporate and private sector levels in general. And unemployment is still a major, major difficulty in many of those crises. Those are the legacies. In addition to the legacies that they are still struggling with and have difficulties addressing, there are those grey clouds on the horizon. Now let's look at those clouds. We have different categories. We have the economic clouds, we have the financial clouds, and we have the geopolitical clouds. Now, I don't pretend that the IMF can push all the clouds. It will require a collective effort, and that's my final point. The first economic cloud that we see is that risk of low growth for a long time. Now, how is that characterized? Well, if you expect growth to be low and lower, and you're an entrepreneur or you're a consumer, particularly if, in addition to that, you envisage relatively low and even lower inflation, you're going to, you know, refrain from investing in new capital expenditure. You're going to refrain from consuming, possibly. And this dynamic could seriously impede the recovery. So it's that sort of vicious circle into which the economy could find itself. And as I said, this is aggravated by the circumstances where you have a combination of low inflation and high unemployment. That is currently the case within the euro area, and in some countries more than in others. The second cloud, still economic, although more monetary, the second cloud that we see on the horizon is that of asynchronous. Who has studied Latin and Greek here? Everybody. So it's the a privativ. So asynchronous, it means that they're not going to be all synchronized together, and they might very well apply the same monetary policy. They are at different moments of the cycle. So the asynchronous monetary policy normalization in advanced economies. And the spillover effects that it will have on other markets. And the back effects that it could have in the domestic market where the normalization is taking place. And those impacts could be of three kinds. Interest rates, variations, which we haven't seen much of lately because they're all rock bottom, and variations of exchange rates. Second category of clouds that we see, financial clouds. There is a concern that financial sector excesses may be building up, especially in advanced economies. Asset valuations are at the highest. Spreads and volatility in almost all sectors, not quite all, but almost all, are at their lowest. Further worry is the migration of new market and liquidity risks outside the banking sector, in what we call the shadow banking sector, which is a non-regulated, non-bank sector, which is growing rapidly in some countries. In the United States, for instance, the shadow banking sector is now considerably larger than the banking sector. In Europe, it is roughly half the size of the banking sector, and in China, at about 25 to 35% of GDP, it is the fifth largest in the world. So it's growing, and what's more about it? It's not all bad, you know. Shadow banking can be just fine in some cases and is needed in some economic space to actually finance economic growth. But the problem about it is that we don't know enough about it. It's quite opaque. And when I say 25 to 35%, it gives you the range of what we know, but also what we don't know about it. So that requires particular attention and probably an expanded type of regulations that will embrace larger and broader than just the banking sector. But it also emphasizes the fact that we need to complete the financial sector reform. And you may have heard a lot about the financial sector reform over the last 6 years because it was inscribed in the objectives of the G20 back in Washington and then London. I was there, I remember. But there are still areas where we have not made the progress that we have to make. And that's the case for the two important-to-fail institutions and the resolution regime that should apply. That is the case also for the derivative markets that need to be safer and more transparent and require exchange of information between those places that actually have a very active derivative market. So, we've talked about the economic clouds, just talked about the financial clouds. I want to talk briefly about the geopolitical clouds. And we have quite a few of those. It's not the direct remit of the IMF, but we have to have them on our radar screen because they have an impact on economic and financial stability as well as prosperity. The first one that I would mention is any escalation that would take place in Ukraine, where it would cause disruption, both in the immediate vicinity, but possibly disruption on commodity prices, for instance. And trade. Second area of possible disruption, clearly the Middle East, and also in some parts of Asia. The third category that I would think of, sorry, the fourth, Ukraine, Middle East, some parts of Asia, is obviously the development of the Ebola virus. If it is not contained, if all the players that talk about it, don't actually do something about it to try to stop it, contain it, and help those three countries deal with it, it might develop into something that would be a very serious concern and could cause significant risks. So all those risks, and some of them are, you know, materializing just a little bit. We have to be careful that they do not develop. And we cannot put them on the back burner. We have to have them on our radar screen all the time. And that is the reason why we must adopt collectively that new momentum that I told you about in order to avoid that horizon of a new mediocre. I hope you've noted something. It's just for you to remember my speech. Mediocre, M. Momentum, M. Multilateralism, M. So I'm on my second M, which is the momentum. That momentum is quite special because it requires a better balance in our policy toolkit, using both the demand and supply side of the economy. Those of you who study economy know about this confrontation, controversies, debates between those that prone supply side measures and those that are in support of demand side measures. The Keynesian on one hand, demand, and many others on the other one, supply. What we are saying is that it has to be a mix of both, and we have to use all the tools that are available. You have a good basketball team here. It's about the same thing as the Hoyas. You have to use all the players. It's not just about attack. It's about defense. It's about moving the ball around. So all players have to play their part in order to score. And it's exactly the same with the economy. Each policy instrument must play its part in order to achieve this momentum. I'll start with the first one, which is the one that is most visible and which has been most effective lately, and that's the monetary policy. It has provided important support to demand. And that has been the case when the Fed decided to start quantitative easing measures. And it has proved efficient. It has done a lot to push recovery. The ECB has done quite a lot as well. There are different moments of the cycle. Bank of Japan is doing a lot. The Bank of England has done a lot. So all the major central banks of advanced economies have pushed that tool. But monetary policy alone doesn't suffice. It's as if you had great defense player, but that's it. You don't score. Plus, the longer easy monetary policies continue, the greater the risk of fueling financial excess. So this needs to be monitored and managed. Equally important, as I mentioned earlier, are the prospects of exiting from that new monetary policy, because it will have implications for other parts of the world. These implications, that's what they call the spillover effects, and the spillback, when it, you know, moves back to the domestic market where decision was made in the first place, that needs to be monitored, that needs to be managed. They need to cooperate and talk to each other extensively. Again, an area where cooperation is needed and where a lot of work needs to be done is in the area of macroprudential tools. And those tools have to be used not only by those advanced economies whenever they see the development of bubbles, for instance, in the housing market, where measures are being adopted by, say, the Bank of England or the Bank of Australia, but also in the emerging market economies, where they have to use the tools available, the macroprudential tools, in order to resist the consequences on their territory of monetary decisions that are made elsewhere. And that would be the case, for instance, of minimum liquidity ratios. So back to the Hoyas. Monetary policy is playing its part, but it needs more support from the rest of the team. And there are three areas where significant effort needs to be made, which means that not enough is being done at the moment. And I will talk successively about the type of fiscal policies and the speed of fiscal policies that we have in mind. I will talk a little bit about one of the reform of markets, which we believe can be efficient. And I will talk briefly about the infrastructure needs that require investment and that can help. So, have you heard about growth-friendly, job-friendly, environment-friendly fiscal policies? Not quite. All right, I'm going to try to explain to you what we mean by that. We believe that intelligent fiscal policies, well calibrated, well designed, can actually help boost growth and jobs. What do I mean by that? I'm not suggesting any stimulus package, because that's not the time. But what I'm suggesting is that because so much has already been done in terms of fiscal consolidation, countries that still need to put their finance in order have to do so at the right pace. Not too fast, not too brutally, and they have to adjust to the circumstances and take them into account. And this is clearly what we do in the programs that we design. We don't push countries into slashing brutally. The pace is important, a sensible pace. Second, they have to be well targeted, because if so, they can contribute as well to boosting growth. For instance, fighting tax evasion, support more efficient public spending, reduce the burden of taxation and charges on labor costs. Payroll taxes, for instance, are clever fiscal measures that can be taken. So it's a sensible mix. Third one, and I come to my environment-friendly measures, we have worked hard and made strong recommendations concerning the reform of energy subsidies. We believe that around the world about $2 trillion are spent on subsidizing people to use energy, and predominantly fossil energy. Now, this is not particularly smart, neither from a fiscal point of view, from a social point of view, or from an environmental point of view, because those who benefit subsidies in most of those countries are those who need it least. They're usually the 10% wealthiest in the population that actually consume a lot of energy and therefore consume a lot of subsidies. And frankly, it also harms the environment. Now, we're not suggesting that they be removed altogether without paying attention and without putting in place a safety net and support for people, you know, who are really in need. That is a prerequisite. But we are suggesting that additional revenue can be generated out of that subsidy removal program. So fiscal policies can actually be growth-friendly, job-friendly, environment-friendly. But, again, this is only some of the players. They cannot substitute for important reforms that need to deal with deep-seated obstacles to growth and development and the creation of jobs. So that brings me to my structural reforms that are so essential. What challenge are we talking about? Predominantly in the advanced economies, but not only in the advanced economies, we are dealing with the challenge of creating jobs for those people looking for one, and making sure that those that are coming to the job market in all countries of the world have the means to access it and make a living out of it. That's the challenge. We currently have about 200 million people looking for jobs, of which 75 million are under the age of 25. And that's what we should focus on. The other thing where we should focus on is the fact that apart from the 1% of the wealthiest around the world, income has been stagnant for most people. And as you quoted me, it's not just a moral issue.